good. How are you?
Oh, I'm hanging in there.
With your favorite book of all time?
We've reached new depths.
Yes, metaphorically and philosophically, I suppose.
Yeah. I had a colleague that I used to work with. Her favorite saying was, "Schlimmer geht immer." It rhymes in German and it means it can always be worse.
I like it. It sounds better in German.
it does. It actually sounds kind of, oh, okay, yeah, we can do that. Yeah. Schlimmer geht immer. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's kind of where I am right now. That was, I don't know. I don't know exactly what it is. I mean, every time I think I understand what he said, then he says something else that just throws me off, you know. And he makes up so many words along the way.
Oh yeah.
Germans, I don't know how the translator actually did it. I mean, German is one of those languages where you can stick words together and kind of glom them onto one another to make new concepts. But he takes this to a whole new level because he puts things together that conceptually don't fit, and then he kind of like puts them in there when he comes up with his like psychoerotic prenatal oral phasing, you know. And I'm going, well, that's nice, except it doesn't say anything, you know. All right, you know, so, but
yeah, it's hard to tell if we just don't have the words for some of these concepts, so we're forced to make them up. But everybody is making them up differently. So.
Well, that's one of the things that one of my problems. I have a bunch of notes that I made, especially when I first started reading them. And the figure that came to mind was Humpty Dumpty.
Oh.
Yes, because I'm going to because he makes words like mean what he wants them to mean. And when I think I kind of understand what a concept is, then he throws a prefix or combines it with another one that just absolutely distorts the meaning of it. And I always have the feeling, well, you know, they mean whatever I think they mean. And so,
yeah,
that's one of those places where I kind of stumble when I'm going along. But from the parts that I did read that were translated into English, it reads much, much better in English than it does in German.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's just, it's a real challenge for me. And, you know, Gaepser was dense, but he was clear.
Yeah.
You know, and this guy, I just can't nail him down. And I'm always one step behind, put it that way. Well, at least that's how I feel.
I definitely know what you're saying about Gaepser. And like Gaepser, I think, for as being clear as he was, like the concepts and what he said stayed with me longer. I read a chapter in this book, I put it down, the next day, you know, I run into Marco and I say something and I have no idea what I just read.
What did he actually say? Yeah, because one of the things that I liked about Gaepser is when he would say something or he'd use a new word and then he would like explain it or provide examples or he kind of lead you through it. And Sloterdijk, he's like throwing color at a canvas. And I understand that can be an artistic technique, and I suppose it's very meaningful to people who get that, but I don't. To me, it looks like paint thrown on the canvas. And I don't know the difference between good paint throwing and bad paint throwing. I don't have that aesthetic wherewithal to be able to decide. And with him, it's just like, well, I'm just throwing stuff at you. Let's see what sticks. And then I find it's like you. The next day, I'm going, I don't know, you know, and I read a lot, you know, and I've always got books in front of my face and I tend to remember things. I mean, it's getting more challenging as I get older, let's face it, but I don't recall things as well as I used to, but this is particularly challenging for me. So I'm glad Marco's here. I'm venting ahead of time.
So yeah, good. Get it all out.
I'm waiting for your discussion.
Well. Discharge. Yeah, so I thought I think Johnny might be joining us. I saw him testing out his connection earlier.
Okay.
So why don't we give it a couple of minutes? Oh, there we go.
Oh, yeah. Speak of the devil and I'll be boss.
All right. So how are we?
Well, we're as good as we can be.
Oh, no. Give him the German phrase.
Schlimmer geht immer.
I like that. Schlimmer geht immer.
Schlimmer geht immer. It can always get worse. And it usually does.
Well, now we're going deeper into the cave, so.
You can call it a cave.
The mother of all monstrosities.
Yeah, I hope that's mud.
Our discussion today.
I hope that's mud there on the ground.
Well, I would like to propose a methodology, if y'all will, for our call. And that is to adopt, as best we can, the method proposed by, and I think articulated by Sloterdijk in this chapter, which is the being inside and outside at the same time. And to propose that we take a kind of turn around, articulating as our response to the text from the inside view, kind of like you're doing, Ben, Ed. But then at the same time, also be occupying that outside view that he sets up as this bayoun for not falling into the traps or excesses of either of those two particular, you know, ends of the polarity. And then, so could we kind of like get in tune with each other by tuning into each other's interior resonances with the text? Mm-hmm. And then on the basis of that attunement, by listening and kind of feeling each other and vibrating with each other in that just, you know, intersubjective mm-hmm. sense first, then from there go to the reflective stance, that sort of objectifying stance, and see what we see from that end of it. And then see if we can like bring it together through some magical synthesis yet to be determined.
Okay.
Hold on, John, I think you're muted.
The text, and then it's from the outside of what exactly?
Well, I'm not suggesting this as a rigid framework. I'm just throwing something out.
And then we're reflecting on something, and then we are resonating. Okay, I got that.
Think of it as just a back of the envelope little sketch of how we might approach the conversation in a way that maybe interiorizes some of what we encountered in the text itself and enacts it in some kind of recursive way. And that might be a fun way to approach it, because there's certainly, I think, Ed, as you were suggesting at the outset here, a kind of throwing things out, right? But kind of also the reverse of that, right? Because the whole object of the text is to figure out where, or go back into where all that stuff is thrown out from. And maybe I'm just starting now. I'll just kind of, you know, give my interior sense of what is happening. But there's I felt uncomfortable with it because this is going into this mother space and this, you know, origin space, which we don't really, you know, it's not polite conversation. So, and it was quite a shift as well from all my other discourses right now, all the other conversations I was involved in, really much more heady and maybe heart oriented, not going into that uterine interior or passing through what Sloterdijk calls the gate of the vulva. So I don't, it was sort of abrupt, but once I got into it, so to speak, I started fetally expanding against the felt limits of the discourse and the text that I was reading, and beginning to see how these pieces maybe corresponded to each other, how we've gone. I went back to the very beginning of the book and reread some passages and noted how we've gone from the description of breath and air to the description of the heart space, or really it's like kind of interspaces to the description of the face and interfaciality, then to the exploration of the sort of inter-energetics or the sort of the magical realm of effects on each other through mesmerism and the bonding and the other thing, the thought transmissions that we discussed last week. Now it's like we're going into the inner sanctum of, I think, what Sloterdijk is kind of getting to with this spheres and bubbles idea, which is the origin. Like, where did these thought forms, where did these shapes, where did these sort of mythic patterns like first emerge from? And he takes us into the mother's interior, which becomes like the archetype for all these other experiences of interiority as we rupture from that. But then also becomes the thing that we want to get back to. And so how do we see that? And at the same time, like, how do we appreciate the fact that for millennia, we've wanted to return to this space of interior, undifferentiated non-subjectivity and non-objectivity, and then at the same time, occupy our space outside that in a critical perspective. So, I kind of got philosophical, I suppose, more abstract, but it got me thinking a lot about the ever-present origin, about Gebser, and about this kind of quest for origin, and about the question of where we come from and who we are, because who we are, as Sloterdijk talks about, is in the sort of matrilineal model, connected to the land becomes a mother. So it just put me back into that space, and I think it could be fruitful to look at like how we experience origin, how we experience that phenomenologically, and also in sort of these spaces themselves. So that's my kind of riff, and I'll pass it off to whoever wants to go next. If, by the way, you want to do this, because I'm open to seeing the desired outcomes of you all as well.
Well, did you say something about being inside and outside at the same time, or did I make that up?
I definitely said that.
Okay.
It doesn't mean you didn't make it up.
Okay.
No, I heard him say
well,
it.
Well, I think that's the paradox that he's playing with and has been playing with all along. And this is outside the text, but I think inside the text as well. Although he talks about Tomatis. He quotes Tomatis at the beginning of this. Who was one of the pioneers working with sound. And he talks about the resonant circle. He also talks about the mother's experience of being a container. But it's a sort of it's a one-way street, really. It's from what I gathered from him, that the mother contains the baby. And that this container metaphor is very central to us. And we, once we're outside of the womb, having gone through that process of being contained and then being partly uncontained and being thrust out into this other world, we bring with us that experience and we project it, the container metaphor, onto just about everything. So what's inside, what's outside, I'm in love, I'm out of love, I'm inside this relationship, I'm outside of it. All the ins and outs and above and beyond and below and around, all those prepositions that we use in our language, we forget or maybe go unconscious about this container metaphor that we habitually use, and it gets reinforced all over the place because that container notion shapes our discourse. So I think this being on the inside and the outside at the same time reminds me of the in topology, they talk about the Klein bottle and the Möbius strip. And, you know, you can take a cylinder and you can twist it, and the inside and the outside become obscured by that twist. And I think that's replicated also in the Klein bottle. I don't know if you know about that, but you can take a rectangle and you can join the rectangle so it forms a cylinder. And then you can take the top and the bottom and you can bring them together and it creates a torus. But if you take the top and you bring it into the middle of the cylinder, it creates a loop. And there's a hole, which is where the inside and the outside disappear in the Klein bottle. And I think this is a very Kleinian kind of notion that he's playing with. And I think the whole notion of a subject, a knowing subject here that knows an object over there, that sort of Cartesian grid that we all operate with, these image schemas, I guess in cognitive psychology, they would call this container metaphor an image schema. These are not something that we create. They're hardwired in us. But then in certain kinds of experience, I think mystical experiences, and I think this is what he refers to, that whole notion gets deconstructed. So it's almost as if we go through that hole in the Kleinian bottle, and the inside and the outside, the knowing subject and the object get dismantled. And this can be a very harrowing experience for some people who've had this experience. But I think to a modest degree, we're all experiencing these kinds of liminal zones where you're in between, where you're inside and outside at the same time. So I think he draws on William Reich. He calls him a fluidist, which I think is a really odd thing to say about him. But that brings in the whole idea of air and breath and self, which is what Reich was dealing with, and how in the yoga practice or pranayama or any breathing techniques you use, and I think Schlotterzeck has done a lot of this kind of practice because he was in a Rajneesh cult for a while. I think we start to reactivate these very subtle kinds of experiences, which I'm sure we had in the womb. And he also brings in R.D. Lang, who was one of a really pivotal figure in the 80s and the 70s. I remember reading him a lot. He wrote a wonderful book called Knots, where he dealt with these paradoxes, and these paradoxes that the Cartesian split, this subject, knowing subject, separated from the known object, creates all kinds of mental illnesses. He was very much a believer that it was the paradigm that drove people crazy. So anyway, those are the kinds of things that I'm taking from this text, and I believe some of it is in the text, and some of it sort of resonates outside of the text, and I believe you can be inside and outside of this text at the same time. So thanks for being part of this. I feel like I'm a member of a magic circle here, so I hope some of that resonates with others. Thank you.
Thanks. I'd like to go. Sorry.
Yeah.
I really impressed with Schlotterzeck. The first thing to say, the level of erudition is really stunning. He really resurrects lineages of thought that aren't always mainstream and does novel things with them that I've never seen. So I'd like to start with the last excursus, which I think is his normative starting point, and that's a discussion of space and being in time, because he actually says what he's rewriting is Heidegger. So that's pretty significant. He's actually telling us that part of this project is a rewriting of Heidegger. So the as I understand being in time, which I have actually read many times, it's a critique of the Vorstellung, the representational model that comes out of Descartes and gets intensified in Kant. And that there's somehow this self-contained subject that somehow can touch the world and create representations of a world in some sense. And Heidegger doesn't simply say that's wrong. What Heidegger says is that it's not deep enough, right? There's something prior to that. And this is being in the world. And being in the world is a non-separation of Dasein and the Inwelt. The world, Dasein and the world really can't be separated. So this is where the subject-object are really kind of folded in this Kleinian sense, you might say. this is the point, and that this is existentially primordial. And then space has to be understood from that perspective, this novel sense of space that Heidegger seems to point to but never unfolds. And that what Sloterdijk is trying to do is agree that there's something off a little bit. I'm not sure what he thinks is off exactly yet, but there's something off about the sense that we're these isolated monads that bump into each other, that we're not these, that sense is some part of the modern problematic, part of the modern dis-ease, that there's a spherical problematic of modernity that leads to various kinds of, he says at the end, psychoses, right? Isn't that interesting? All psychoses are these problematics of spherology. And then what he's doing is he seems to be trying to trace what these non-subject-object senses of human being are. And he traces it, I think, in two ways. One's historical, which I found odd. And that is, he sees the rise of this sense with the mother womb in the Neolithic period, but why that should matter is not clear to me, right? Like, it's not in the Paleolithic strong. He speaks of a post-Neolithic, and then at some point, this father principle comes forward more. So why is the Neolithic more true to the depths of existential experience than the other historical periods? And why did that only show up in terms of imagery and metaphors in the Neolithic period and not prior after that? So that's one question. I don't understand how that works for him. And then the second, I thought was the most fascinating, is he's critiquing analytic psychology and the stages of development. And that seem to have built into them, surprisingly, subject-object notions. And draws on Lange and others and tries to push it back into inception. And then I'm not sure if he believes it all, but came up with two or three models, including a Taoist model, that there's something, the human emergence is these phases, without him taking sides on which phase. And so that's my sense of what he's doing. And my only, my outside nervousness about this is that what degree he's falling a little into what Ken Wilber what's called pre-trans fallacies, that he's looking for the prior developmental phases. And it's one thing to say that we're out of whack with them. It's another thing to say that they are overriding later developmental structures. And I'm not sure he's giving a lot of credence to, you know, all the work of developmentalisms that do seem to have empirical grounding in some way, that where boundaries show up, of some, permeable boundaries do appear of some kind that are personal. And I don't know what he makes of that, other than what seemed to me in certain places a dismissal. So that's my confused and response, not quite following Marco's instructions.
My instructions were not... They were not the most precise, but they weren't instructions, they were suggestions.
Guidelines, which I was trying to follow, but did not.
Okay. I would love to follow up on a couple of things you said, but yeah. I do want to let Ed and Wendy kind of present their thing, yeah, and see what bubbles back up when we've gone through everyone. Wendy?
Well, one of
how do you feel about a bunch of guys doing negative gynecology over here?
Well, you know, I actually thought about that getting onto this call today. I'm like, gee, I hope another woman shows up because I'm the only one here representing somebody with an actual womb. So, and having not had children, I have pets. I don't know, you know, interpret that as you will, as to whether I agree with this whole mother theology or not. One of the things I shared with Ed earlier is, because of the language and because of the concepts that he's presenting, they don't stick with me as much as some of the, like the Gebser reading and some of the other things I read. So, you know, I can read the chapter and think I have an understanding of what's going on. And if you ask me 24 hours later what I thought about it, I don't even remember what the chapter was about. So, you know, in preparation for this call, I kind of went back and looked at the things that I had highlighted and things that struck me. And, you know, being that pragmatist and the person who's always trying to figure out how to pull this into, you know, June 22nd, 2017, I thought it was interesting about, you know, that we're always trying to, the whole, you know, the idea that we leave the womb, we go on this journey, and we're all trying to get back there. You know, whether that back there is back to home, back to somewhere safe, or, you know, parallel with that was the idea of the womb being a source of truth and getting back to a place where you know, like this higher learning, and that you have to lose yourself, you have to lose your senses, you have to have a self-disillusion, I think was the term he used, you know, to enter the inner sanctum where now the knowledge is bestowed on you and you're in the in crowd, so to speak. And again, you know, the first thing that came to mind was all those stupid, you know, rituals and organizations that we've developed. And there's always some sort of initiation that goes through with that, where you're supposed to, you know, like in the fraternity of the sororities, you get hazed and you're supposed to lose your individuality and you're supposed to bond with your fellow initiates. And then you go through this whole ritual and now you become part of the inner circle and you're a brother and you're the sister. And now you've been given all the knowledge and the secrets of the fraternity. You know, social organizations are like that. Religious organizations can be like that. And so I just thought that was interesting and how that has persisted. And if I thought about it longer, I'd have to think whether we had any of our own little initiations or rituals getting to this point with the, you know, the five of us that are here today, our own little inner circle, so to speak. So that was one of the things I was thinking about, and how that metaphor of the idea of losing yourself to become a part of something, either part of something bigger or part of something smaller, where you just want to come back to being home, somewhere safe, somewhere where you're accepted, and not, you know, an individual out there fighting on your own. So I'm kind of playing around with that idea. The other idea I thought was interesting was when we got, I liked the Lang sections, and I haven't completed all of them, but I liked the idea of giving some sort of a credence to pre-birth experiences. And I actually thought about that. I mean, he mentioned it in the one paragraph about how, like, the implantation stage can be very violent or scary, or you're beating your head against a wall, or you're trying to get in and you can't, and you're fatigued. And I'm like, well, I'm like, shit, do we carry that with us into the world too? Like, when we finally get out, we're just so freaking exhausted and like, okay, now I'm here, now what? You know, so I thought, like, again, I'm wondering, you know, of those experiences, if there are actual threads that we carry through. Now, to Mike's point, I don't know if they override some of the other developmental stages that, you know, follow after the birth experience. But at least, you know, as Gebser would say, you know, there's a little bit of the myth and the magic all the way through. There may be threads of those, inception and conception and developmental experiences in the womb that do carry through it, whether they're traumatic or not. You know, I can't imagine everybody's prenatal experience is beautiful. You know, there's people who use drugs, there's people who get into accidents, there's people who fall over and, you know, things happen and, you know, do we carry those scars with us? So those are the kinds of things I'm thinking about right now.
Cool. Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you. Ed, what do you think?
What do I think? How do I say this? I'm a person that has trouble remembering what happened to him prior to puberty. I'm one of these people that thinks that something happened a long time ago. It turns out it was a few years ago. I have, my wife complains about this a lot. I have no real, how do I say this, distinct time-based memory frames that I can refer to. Things were in the past. They happened. I can't order them temporally. I don't know where that stuff is. I suppose it's in there somewhere in whatever it is that I call my consciousness. But I also had to think a lot when I was reading this, how long it takes an individual, once we're outside the womb, to develop any kind, even the remotest sense of self, how long that takes, and how much is involved in doing that. And then once you have that, how long it takes to even concretize a self that you can address and deal with in any kind of sensible way. Most of the people I know aren't there yet, and some of them are close to death. They're old because they never really figure out who they are. And so when Mr. Sloterdijk comes along and says, well, we have all of this shit that happens to us in a stage where we have zero awareness, the only place that can go is in our unconscious. Well, now I have to decide, do I actually think we have an unconscious? And if I do, what might it even look like? Is it a Jungian kind of unconscious? Or is it a Sloterdijkian kind of unconscious? Because Sloterdijk's unconscious is tied to things that are so specific, I can't believe that they're true. He talks about things as if he knows what he's talking about, and he can't possibly know. He can't. Unless he's had some kind of, let's say, life earth-shattering mystical experience that revealed this to them. And I've never had one as big as I would have liked to have had, but from the little ones that I have had, none of them ever involved the womb. And of all the people I know who ever became enlightened, never one of them ever said, oh, it's like a womb, or I got back to the womb. They got to where they are because I personally, the idea of containership, Johnny brought this up, the idea of containership is a very, very fundamental one. But there are a lot of ways to understand what a container is or what a container can mean or what is the essence of a container. And I spend a lot of times in more esoteric circles. And although I would agree with Wendy that most initiations are pretty hokey, if you've ever gone through a real one, you know how real they are. And it's a whole different way of accessing things, and not one of them, not one that I've ever gone through. And I, believe me, I've gone through dozens in my life. Ever involved the womb. They've involved death. They've involved life. But they've never involved the womb for some reason.
But you were born.
I was born, but I don't remember that. You see, I'm not one of those people and go, oh yeah, I can remember coming down the tunnel and there was this going on. And I'm not one of those. I can't, like I said, I can't remember what happened when I was 12. I don't remember what happened when I was minus 4 months. You see, those are things that he says that I cannot relate to through any experience that I've ever had. So I always, and I think that all of us kind of go at our reading with whatever it is that we think we are and what we've gathered together from our reading and from our own experience. And those are experiences I've never had. I go, okay, well, maybe. I mean, I'm not saying he's wrong. I'm just saying from the way I'm reading it, maybe it's the way I'm reading it or the way he's writing it or presenting it. I'm not sure that he knows. I don't understand why it's necessary to go on for 25 pages about pre-birth or Raoul phases that we go through. What does I'll pick up a line that Wendy's brought up before. What does this do for me in my everyday life? How does this help me to come to terms with my reality better? I don't get it. I don't see the connection. I don't know why that matters. Why is that so important that I have to spend so much time dealing with it? So I kind of get my things from more direct ways or direct images, if I can say that. One of the things that I've spent a lot of time studying is Kabbalah. And there's an old saying that says, well, if you don't understand what's in the Torah, Hashem in his infinite wisdom gave us the key to this in the first book that we understand of the Torah is Genesis. This was originally just a big string of letters. And he said, if you read the first book and you don't get it, Hashem and all his wisdoms, well, he put it all in the first chapter. And so you can read the first chapter. And he goes, well, if you don't get it when you're reading the first chapter, Hashem and all his wisdom, put it in the first letter. So the key to the Torah is the first letter of the Torah. Okay. And the first letter of the Torah is the Hebrew word beit. It's not the first letter of their alphabet, because that first letter is Aleph, but the first letter is beit. And beit means house. It's a house. And what beit does is, and this is where we come to the containers that Johnny came in, it distinguishes the inside from the outside. It causes a distinction. Because before everything was created, before we had heaven and earth, or the Big Bang, or whatever it was, there was no distinction. There was no way to know this or that. This is what really upsets me about people who get down on subjectivity and objectivity, or the subject-object distinction. If we don't distinguish, if we cannot discriminate in some way, how can we know? Because we can't. We have to do these things. Now, this distinction between inside and outside may or may not be, how should I say it? It's not earth-shattering, but it's earth-creating, because we have to be able to discern. The first lesson in Kabbalah is to learn to discern. You have to start making distinctions. You have to start being able to separate, to look at. Maybe it is an analytical process if we look at it intellectually. But oddly enough, the righteous man or the righteous woman, the righteous human being, is a person whose insides are like his outsides. He becomes transparent. He becomes diaphanous in Gibbsarian terms. You can see right through him because you see what he is for what he is, or she. The distinction then goes away, but first you have to have the distinction for it to disappear. Just like you have to have an ego before you can transcend it. You have to have awareness before you can realize there's an unconscious. And it's in this stepping through this in a way that unfolds meaningfully is what I miss in Sloterdijk. So this is my outside comment. This is why I fight with him so much. Because to me, there's a lot simpler way to say this. If that's what he's saying. And the thing that still fascinates me after five sessions that we've gone through here, I've not heard one person anywhere ever make a comment, including myself, who said, I think that's what he's saying, or maybe somebody can help me understand what he's saying. Why is it that all of us at this point in time still don't know what he's saying? We know sometimes what we think he's saying, but why don't we know? What does that say something about him or us or all of us or everybody who reads them? These are the things that preoccupy me then after I'm done reading. And like Wendy, I read this all day yesterday, and there's not a whole lot of it there other than that, the stuff that really got my goat, okay?
All right, so what's Sloterdijk? What do we think Sloterdijk is saying? I'd like to know as well.
Yeah, well,
I have some ideas, but I think, I mean, you're raising a fair point. And I think it probably has some connection to what Michael referred to earlier as the pre-trans fallacy, because in a sense, you know, going
to the moon. I found that a very helpful notion all of a sudden. It helped. A couple of things went to get it into a little bit of a framework.
I think someone mentioned Heidegger's work, and he says, Sloterdijk says, the present project spheres can be understood as an attempt to recover, in one substantial aspect at least, the project wedged sub-thematically in Heidegger's early work.
Yeah, that's
so he's pretty explicit in several places about what the project is. And then, much like that hole in the Kleinian bottle or that twist in the Möbius strip, we are both and, either or, and neither or. We're in that in-between, that liminal zone. Where boundaries are not clear, and it isn't orientable. I use that word in topology too. The sphere is not orientable. Unlike a flat surface where there are edges, as you may recall, in the old days, they told the sailors, be very careful because you don't want to go to the edge and fall off. They had this image of, you know, a flat surface. It was really large, and they looked above and saw the dome above them at night. But I think this is what he's playing with, how our modern world has deconstructed all of that, and the sphere opens up all kinds of paradoxes. And the big question he asked in the first couple of chapters is not who are we, but where are we? And I think that theme is something very compelling, as here we are using technology on different continents, different time zones, yet we somehow find replicating that idea of a magic circle. So we're here together for this time in this adventure we're having in consciousness. We may be doing something new and different. Most people and most have been face-to-face. That's how they organize their lives. And they may have stayed very close to where they were born. We don't live in such a world anymore. And I think this is the paradox that he's pointing to. And he is explicit on occasion, not too often. But I do point that out to you, that he can be explicit. A lot of it is implied, a lot of it is vague, a lot of it is amorphous, ambiguous, as is a Klein bottle or a Möbius strip. I think those are very good metaphors. He hasn't used them exactly, I don't think. Maybe he will later, but he definitely uses the sphere. And the Kleinian bottle, the Möbius strip, all come out of the study of topology. So anyway, I'm just throwing that out there because I think you're leaving something, I think you're missing something in your reading. That is in the text. Also, you mentioned, Ed, the memory frame. Mm-hmm. That was important to you, and how long it takes to concretize a self. Mm-hmm. I think that's a great research question all of us have. And you pointed out that there are some elderly people you know who haven't made it yet. Mm-hmm. And I think that's an ongoing, our ongoing embodiment requires us to speculate on that. And I believe that there are, I have memories prenatal. Mm-hmm. I have a memory, and he points out in the Taoist tradition, it all begins at conception. Mm-hmm. The life begins at conception, not when the baby is born. And R.D. Lang says the same thing. He says that it isn't controversial for R.D. Lang that people remember these experiences in the world. It isn't controversial for me because I've done a lot of trance work. I've done a lot of breath work. I've done a lot of pranayama. I was part of what was called the rebirthing community back in the 70s and the 80s. I was I don't know if you heard of Groff, Groff work. This is all before the New Age had even started, and I was playing with this stuff. So, and I never did drugs. Although a lot of people that I knew did, but I never needed to. It just seemed to me like I was one of these people who was unlucky enough to just have these spontaneous kind of LSD-like experiences. So my challenge has not been to open up to these experiences. My very big challenge is ongoing is how to integrate them, certainly how to articulate something that makes sense, which is not easy to do once you have these experiences, because they're profoundly pre-linguistic or trans-linguistic, if you want to put it that way. And I do think there's a danger of, the pre-trans fallacy of elevating certain experiences or reducing certain experiences. Okay. That's I think what was mentioned earlier about the possible Wilberian pre-trans fallacy that he may be committing. I don't find him doing that too much. Although that's an ever-present danger. So anyway, I'm just throwing that out there just to add something to the mix that I'm sure that there are some experiences in the womb that are very, that many people can recall. Most people do not. Mm-hmm. This may have something to do with language. And when language kicks in, that's when they start to remember things. But I've also think that memory may be distributed among groups. I have had a journal I've kept for 40 years. And I remember reading my journal. I hardly ever read it, but when I do, I'm shocked because I don't remember any of this at all. And some pivotal persons who are very important in this narrative, I don't remember them. And if I hadn't written it down in a journal, I would it would have totally been erased. So I think memory is often distributed in our archives or in our museums or in our conversations that we have. What we remember, what we forget, has a lot to do with who we're with. So I just want to open that up as something that he's talking about as we redesign ourselves in our post-postmodern world. How are we going to do that if we don't know exactly where we come from, speculate where we're going? I do believe a compelling future is possible for us, and I do believe if we use our imaginations that this has a very profound effect on our present. If we're using our imaginations to create horror stories, so be it. But it's not necessary for us to do that. So I believe he is I think he's going to go into the imaginal realm a lot more than he has, because I think has a lot to do with who we are and where we are. So thank you.
Great.
I hope some of that made sense. This is what's being triggered for me by this text.
I'd like to also report when I mentioned pre-trans fallacy as a speculation. I've done a lot of Groff work too, a lot of rebirthing, also a lot of ascendant meditation, the whole spectrum. And what I'd say is so far reading the text is that, let me mention another writer. His name is Michael. He has a whole model of moving out of the mother. And the mother is the dynamic ground of these causal subtle energies. And he has a model that allows for growth, development, and then separate lines that have to come back. So it's not an either or. It's not like development and forming these higher level boundaries of a self and these different capacities are wrong. It's that in that process, there's simultaneously a loss and there can be deep shadow going back into the womb and so on. And that also has to be dealt with. And he calls this transcendence in the service of regression, regression in the service of transcendence. So he kind of combines a regressive model like this, which I think this is in some ways, and a developmental model, and says these are different folds of our being. And I find that very useful. I don't find that here. I don't see where the development of dialectical thinking has any place. Good about modernity that allows this? What are the conditions of possibility allowing his genealogical investigation? Because I think he's a critic of modernity. He's looking at our conditions. He sees certain suffering. He sees a collapse of certain kinds of cultural immunological systems, which are spherological. They've broken down. Part of the problem is the sense of a subject. It's not just Cartesian. He's traced it. That's what he's tracing in these prior chapters. This sense of no longer having heart permeability or breath or eye permeability or self-other permeability. It's become this solitary subject, and it shows up in sciences in the 19th century and all these different places. So that seems to be his critique, but I'm not sure what he sees as positive in modernity. And then finally, I really objected to him collapsing Shankara's description of very, very expansive states of consciousness. Whether they're valuable or not is another question. I think they are. But expansive states of consciousness and reducing them to womb experiences, I think that is completely false. Mm-hmm. I think there's some overlap. I have my own model of this. But actually, there are no boundaries, right? What happens in a Dzogchen-style Rigpa sense of things, the notion of a womb, it's sometimes used in the Tibetan tradition, it's just not really what's operative. It's just not what's going on anymore. And I just don't see that as coming out of this prenatal experience. I that part of it doesn't resonate.
Michael, do you think that he's making that mistake? That he is?
With states of consciousness, yes. Yeah, I don't think...
Because I had an open question about that. I'm not sure. But I think he's looking at the psychoanalytic tradition. He mentions Freud as being a positivist. Mm-hmm. He mentions modernism as being producing psychosis.
Yes.
And I agree with you there that he's definitely a critic of modernity.
Yeah.
And he's looking at psychoanalysis, and the basic mistake that Freud made was to reduce experiences of the womb, to reduce mystical experience to was a byproduct of experience of the oceanic bliss of the womb. So it's a regressive tendency, but without any of what you were talking about, is Michael Washburn's idea of regressing so that you can transcend. Did I get that right? Yes. Yeah. So it's a healthy kind of regression. And we can do that all the time. We can regress very safely into former stages, and we can bring information with us to face challenges that we're dealing with in the present. So this is something that we can draw upon as a tremendous resource. I think it gets problematic when we talk about the worshiping the inner child and mistaking it for the most important archetype we have, because it isn't. Definitely you don't want the inner child running the show, but it's definitely something that a resource. And I'm just opening that up because I'm not sure he's made pre-trans fallacy.
Well, I hear you. I love the sensitivity you're bringing to reading the text. Yeah, I don't know either. I'm really putting this as a question. One place I really got nudged wasn't with Freud, with his discussion of Nirgana Brahman in Shankara's work, in Vedantic tradition, and linking that kind of sense of no thingness in a kind of void space, which is a classic state Nirvikalpa Samadhi experience, which I've had. It doesn't seem anything womb-like to me. It doesn't fit the descriptions of the womb-likeness that he's offered us.
Right.
So that didn't resonate correctly to me, that one piece.
Right. That's cool. I'm wondering if anybody had a response to the story that he tells about the old child. There's a sage who's in the womb, his mother's womb for, I don't know, 80 years. and at night, I think it's in the daytime, he leaves. He checks out of the womb and just comes back at night. Or maybe it's the other way around. I can't remember, but he's obviously drawing on a mythopoetic kind of construction.
The Lao Tzu, I think.
That's Lao Tzu.
Referring to Lao Tzu, yes.
That's the myth of Lao Tzu's birth.
Yeah, and as soon as he's born, the mother looks at him and dies of fright because he's an old man. But I think there's some. That to me is very suggestive that he used that story, and I wasn't familiar with it, so it sort of moved me in a way.
I think this is
an ancient process, and if you've had these experiences. You feel like, oh, this is really old. Our species has gone through this many, many, many times. Unfortunately, I think we tend to, our modern ego has a lot of trouble with that. Anyway, I'm just sharing that. I'm curious about how other people responded to it.
Well, I mean, I think that example, I mean, for me, I found it really beautiful and really just fantastic. And actually, like poetically very simple and profound at the same time, that example. And I took it as an indication of how a mythological consciousness could use the metaphors at its disposal. In this case, the mother metaphor, the womb metaphor, and then transpose it transpose it into a cosmic context, into a kind of absolute context. And I think part of what it said to me, or part of what I think Sloterdijk might have been signaling with that example, is that there's something in the human experience that leads us to want to articulate our being in the whole, our being inside, what our absolute context is. And there is a maturation process that occurs there, which the figure of Lao Tzu maturing inside of a womb and then being born into a larger, you know, a much larger womb, an absolute womb, and in a sense giving birth in this kind of Mobius strip sort of way to himself, that is it's a parable for the you could say the developmental process from immaturity, subject object types of relations to subject object relations to trans or non-dual, we might say. And I thought that going back to that methodological question, which is, you know, is also an epistemological question, like how do we know, right? Like what I think Sloterdijk is suggesting, and in particular with regard to the sort of regression therapy type work or this sort of investigation into these origins, these intimate origins of our sense of self, what I think he's suggesting is that you have to do both. You have to be a participant observer. And I think that in that way, the participant part is the one that says, well, what was it like to be born? And then proceeds with that investigation in, maybe it happens spontaneously, or maybe it happens through breath work or through LSD psychotherapy or what have you. But then doesn't relinquish thereby the critical perspective or the perspective that comes with modernity, right? That ability to be outside of the cave, not lose oneself in the undifferentiated experience or in the oceanic bliss or what have you. And I think he's seeing traces of these really, really primal, universal human experiences in the ways that mythologies are constructed. And then in some kind of, I mean, to get to the part about modernity, the critique of modernity, that's broken down, that there's something wrong there. There's something that hasn't, that's not happening as perhaps it should, or it would more healthfully happen, like in these, in our larger sphere formation process, or in this kind of moment of sphere dissolution, sphere collapse, the madness of modernity that he talks about, that he really ends this chapter with. And I guess the last reflection on that is that what I think this book is about, and what I think Sloterdijk is saying, to your point, Ed, is that I think he's making a point about media, and he's really, like, that comes through in all these moments, in all these spheres. They all have their own media, and he talks at one point about this media sickness, and how when the material, right, which of course is mother related, the mater, the material is mother, when that becomes infected, becomes disturbed in the process of moving from one birth to the next, from one sphere to the next, then we can become kind of stuck, and we become these kind of neuroses that are tied to places where that transition didn't happen completely or smoothly or in a sort of, there's a residue, right, that we haven't yet digested. And so I see this text as kind of trying to bring that out, trying to tease out, like, what is going on in our, like, most intimate psyches. And we have to get into these primordial experiences, our interfaciality, our bioenergetics, and our sense of, you know, our relation to a womb, our relation to that enclosing space, which, and what we really want. Why do we want that? Why do we want to be enclosed? Does that lead somewhere?
Well, why do we want to be enclosed?
We feel safe.
I understand that part, but the point, you know, one of the things that is said in the New Testament, for example, is you'll know the truth and the truth will set you free. So is that free within or without a bubble? But because, and this is what I keep hearing Sloterdijk saying, you got to enclose, you got to get it, you have to get this into space, you got to get your space together. You have to make a distinction between whatever and whatever else. He's always making these distinctions and cutting off. I don't see where this is actually liberating. I don't see where this is, you know, and I think your point's well taken, Marco. He does very explicitly, at least as far as I read that, towards the end of this chapter, tell us. And this goes back to what you said as well, Johnny. He gets very explicit at some point and said, the only way we can understand this is in medial conceptual terms. And when I hear somebody say the only way to do something, I'm going, I'm out of here. Because if that's the only way, then all of us for the entire history of humanity have been living incorrectly. And we had to wait till Sloterdijk came along to clear us up on this.
Well, the
people who said we're only biological subjects. That was the whole sociobiology, they tried to get that out of. That's the whole problem I have with neo-Darwinism. It's only this. It's only biology. It's only physics. That's so reductive. That is so enclosing. That's so encapsulating. And there's no safeness in that. There's no security in that. There's restriction. And I'm going, okay, well, do I need that? Is this what he's telling me?
Well, we do need it and we don't need it. I mean, we need a safe container, they called it in therapy. But also, it gets really boring. You get bored shitless being in a safe container, so you want to break out. And this is true of many of our relationships and institutions we belong to, and then we disaffiliate from them. Mm-hmm. I wanted to just quote our author here, because I think he says something that's of use to me. He's talking about the Neolithic revolution and the primary presence of of magical potential. And he says basically world history is in motion as a series of wars between telepathic and influenced psychotic possession groups, better known under the name cultures. The presence, magical conviviality of the oldest cultures depended on the neurolinguistic and neurosensitive domain. Dense parallel programmings of the brain ensembles enabled the members of the group to function in great interpersonal proximity and intimate conductivity. That has been broken down. You're on, you know, if you're doing Facebook or social media or whatever, you're not in that kind of close proximity to a brain on multiple brains. And I think this is sort of, I know in my own experience, I remember a very profound experience that I had right at the beginning of the AIDS epidemic. People were terrified of this, people with AIDS. Actually, we really didn't have a label for it. It was prior to the AIDS label being concocted by the medical industrial complex. But we did have these syndromes, and people were getting very sick, and they were dropping dead in large numbers. And I remember going to, I heard about a group. I had a friend who died. I was very heartbroken, and I knew I had to do something. I didn't know what, but I was waking up in the middle of the night thinking, oh, my God, I got to do something. And I heard about there was a group of people who were sick. And I went to the apartment, and there were about six men scattered around the room, all in like a fetal position, and they were they took turns mumbling about something miserable that had happened about their condition, and they had been scorned and thrown out of their families. They lost their jobs. No one wanted anything to do with it. And someone asked me, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "I really don't know. I'm not sick. I don't want to get sick. I want to stay healthy. And I know I need to maintain my own health. I need a group of people who are going to support health." And I did something very weird from my theater background and my therapy background. I just asked everyone to get in a circle on the floor, and I asked everyone to hold hands, and they complied. And then I said, "Let's chant." And I started to sound like the death song of a dying whale. I mean, it was, but after a while, there became some beautiful tones and more beautiful tones. And they were overtones. It was like sitting in a group of Tibetan chants, you know. It was a beautiful kind of brain, that brain ensemble kind of thing. We were in the resonant magic circle. And people started hearing about this, and they came out in droves. And we need to get out of that apartment, and we got a large loft space, and hundreds of people showed up. And it was basically the same format, but it was getting bigger and bigger and bigger, so we had to split up the groups, so we had two or three groups going on each week. And I basically trained different leaders of the group to do basically this same format. And it spread, and there were these kind of healing circles all over the place. And we're talking about Manhattan in 1980. And it wasn't until a few years later that I heard about the New Age from acupuncturist at a cocktail party was talking about the New Age, and I say, oh yeah, I think I know about the New Age. I think I've been playing with at the edges of this. So I'm just supporting this notion of these face-to-face kind of the magic circle, the resonance, the touch, the sound mm-hmm. that people can make. And this is magical and it's ancient and it works. It can work. It can also backfire horribly. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that was all that people were doing. People were doing other things that were mm-hmm. of use to them. But I don't think the personalizing ego kind of psychology was useful at all. Most of it was just fell flat. And most of the models that most of the professional therapists were using were absolutely useless.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's happened. I think it's happening now as well.
See, and I agree with you, Johnny, 100%. My only question is, what does that have to do with what Sloterdijk has said? Because in all that you said, there wasn't a womb there either.
Well, he's talking...
Where were we going back to? I understand the effectivity of what you were doing. That makes sense. That makes perfectly good sense to me.
Well, let me add. Well, I found the quote. It's on page 265. He's talking about brains as media. And this, I think, refers to something that you were talking about earlier, Marco. Brains are media for what other brains do and have done. Intelligence only receives the key stimuli for its own activity from other intelligence. Like language and emotion, intelligence is not a subject, but a milieu or resonance circle. I think we may be doing a variation on that resonance circle right here as we gather together and hash out what the multiple meanings of this text could be.
I don't get that either.
I hope that supplied something to what you were, to your inquiry, because I think you were looking for something in the author that supported what I was, my self-disclosure here. And I'm not just telling a story. I'm actually trying to connect my personal experience, my first-person phenomenological account of what happened to this text. And I would invite all of us to do that. Bring your own stories to this. And it may activate and trigger certain deeper responses to the text. I believe he's not doing that himself, because he's a philosopher and he's going more and more into abstractions. But I think, you know... You can do whatever you want to with this text. I don't feel any obligation to, look at all of his footnotes, although I do, and figure out what it is he's up to. I'm playing with this. And I'm saying, well, how can this be useful for me? And I do feel that there's some resonances that I'm trying to share and open up to and articulate. I apologize if this is coming across a little incoherent, because it is. It's not easy to put this stuff into words.
You know what? You just triggered something with that story, and something that Marco had said about maybe what Sloterdijk is saying is that there's a media sickness right now, and the sickness is that we're out of touch with the mediums of these communications or feelings or expressions or concepts, you know, and maybe that's the missing link. Maybe, you know, if we're not in tune with other people's hearts, if we're not in tune with other people's breath, or our own breath, if we're out of tune with, if we're not looking face-to-face, although I would challenge that. I think, okay, in my, you know, my 21st century thinking, I'm like, well, looking at faces on Facebook is still communing with different minds and still communing with different faces.
In a different way.
It's a different medium. And it kind of, in a way, it almost like, what's the word? It kind of validates, you know, the current media landscape, as opposed to it always being negative and it's something that's intrusive and nothing that's destroying us. Maybe this is just the medium of the age, and maybe we're not using it the way that we should be using it in order to use like the heart and the blood that we talked about and sound. You know, I think sound is very powerful, just, you know, your story illustrated that beautifully, that sometimes that's the medium that you need in order to heal. And maybe it's our disconnection from that in modernity that Sloterdijk is questioning. You know, I would just take the next step further. It's like, okay, well, how do we look back on how do we come more heart connected or more breath connected, but at the same time, use the media that we've got now, use the internet, use Facebook, use, you know, some of the stuff that they're doing with neuroscience and computers and circuitry. Who knows what that might lead to in terms of consciousness, in terms of connectedness.
Thank you very much. That really was very helpful.
Well, if we look at the womb as a kind of medium, or rather the aspects of it, the blood, the sound environment, and then coming out into breath, I mean, that's a medium that's very real. I mean, even if your mystical experiences don't include the womb, nonetheless, every woman on the planet has a womb. All of us came into human physical incarnated existence through a womb. And so our first experience of communication,
that's not necessarily true.
In utero, yeah.
Yes, they have not come into existence through the womb. They've come into existence by means of the womb, because cesarean sections are going on rampantly in the United States, for example. Mm-hmm. And there are those, I don't know if they're right or wrong, I just want to bring this up, but there are lots of psychologists are saying this is very, very, having very negative effects on the psyches of the people who are being born.
Right. Well, I mean, that's to the point that the womb is significant. It's a significant media to think about.
Yes, it is. I agree. I agree with that part of it. Yeah.
So, I mean, is he making a claim about truth? Is he making a larger claim? Is he equating the womb with absolute truth? I don't think he's doing that. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that mm-hmm. he's presenting these illustrations of how the womb metaphor informs our metaphysics as a way of clarifying that when we think about our ultimate context and when we think about our media, that we're not confusing it with these desires to go back to the spaces that are undifferentiated, because that's kind of part of the pre-trans fallacy, is to think we're getting smarter, to think we're gaining knowledge or going beyond, when in actuality we're dissolving important differentiations and deconstructing, he makes a little jab at deconstructionists, important distinctions, like you were saying earlier, Ed. So I don't see him arguing against the importance of distinctions. I see him presenting a kind of developmentalism, but it's this sort of development as moving from one rupture to the next in different environments and different media environments. And I think that he's pointing out the ways that we confuse our current media environments with these unsatisfied longings to return to something more originary, some sense that we have some residue that we feel about where we came from and who we are, which has been like destroyed because these larger spheres and shells are all broken.
Well, Marco, I have a question then. So, I love what you said. I loved it. I resonated with it. It's the question of, is there still a critique for adults in modernity inherent in what he's saying beyond longing to go back to the womb, that somehow the cultural development of not just metaphysics, but I don't know, habitations that deal with these spheres and the sense of the other in terms of these microspheres, that something has been wounded in modernity with the closure of a subject, with what he's going to later call globalization, with new forms of media that are not breath. In other words, is he just warning us about not confusing this history of spheres with longing to go back, or is there something still pregnant in those metaphors, cultural metaphors, that we're losing or are damaged in some way?
Yeah, I don't know.
I might not have been very clear expressing that question. Is he, in losing the metaphors of certain kinds of spheres and certain arrangements of certain kinds of spheres and certain kinds of media relations, is there some loss of well-being that he's concerned with?
Mm-hmm. I, you know, I think it gets to the question of the integral, actually. And I found that there was something in this chapter that to me filled in something that Gebser left out, actually, which is what the real, that he touched on, but he really gave it minimal, he gave it a lot less attention than the other structures of consciousness. But that's the archaic, the originary. What really is the, what's the felt experience of that? And what are the ways in which that continues to live in us and inform and affect us? There's, if not a longing for the womb, there's some longing for origin, for, and what is that? That archaic idea, or Terence McKenna called it the archaic revival, this idea that we can go back, quote unquote, to sort of an originary emergence. Talks about the admission of space. It was a weird translation issue. But we want to be born again, maybe. Like, perhaps there's something in us in this time, in this sort of that is a birth kind of process. Maybe there's something useful in that language if we don't fall into it uncritically, is what he's saying.
I don't know. I mean, my question was authentic. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Because this is only the first 300 pages of a 3,000 page genealogy.
Yeah.
Followed by two books, which are more a response to, okay, what do we do now? You know, You Must Change Your Life and The Art of Philosophy, which are really the kind of response to this history. So,
well, isn't the transition between oral cultures and literate cultures sort of fraught with peril? I mean, Plato and Socrates, they thought a lot about this stuff. And also the nature of memory. Because once we start writing things down and we are in book culture, we can be alone in ways that we could not have been before, where we had to tell stories, you know, in order to create some sort of bonds between people. And I know I spend a lot of time with books, and I think some of you guys do too. There's something womb-like about entering into that relationship with an author that is like nothing else, mm-hmm. and is quite magical. And for me, I would be miserable. Yeah, I can be alone because I have books and I have music and I can do my own thing. But I think there's a bit of an illusion there that it's just totally a private experience. Because for me, when I read a book or read an author or read a poet or whatever, see a movie, I enter into a field. And there is something very resonant if you're really in the zone with a good author. Anyway, I'm just pointing that out to us. It's probably pretty obvious. But I think when we're here together in these calls and we're talking about our reading experience, which we can only do alone, you can't read a book with a committee, you know. You have to do it on your own. You take notes, and it's a lot of it will be very idiosyncratic, probably. I imagine the being born, each time nature and the environment and the DNA come together in a certain way, there's something novel that's happening. So anyone who might remember something in the womb may be remembering something that isn't universal, but very idiosyncratic. And I mentioned earlier the gynecologist who was a hypnotist who hypnotized one of his patients, and she recalled her mother trying to abort her with a hat pin. There is a very, I don't know that oceanic bliss actually captures what's happening in utero for a lot of people. So I'm just putting that out there along with everyone else's question marks about where this text might be going, because I'm not sure. But I don't think, I think he's oversold the oceanic bliss of the womb, or maybe he got that from Freud in his sort of pre-trans fallacy making. Because I definitely doubt it. Maybe it does begin with conception, but what was there before conception? Who knows? I think we do get glimpses of it, and I think that's where that Kleinian bottle metaphor sort of the visual analog, or the Möbius strip, those twists and those blackouts, the amnesia that happens as you enter in those zones, either before the subject-object thing gets set up or after the subject-object breaks down, once you have that self and it's concretized, what happens when you start feeling all those fissures and those cracks in it. Some of it is produced by trauma, but maybe not. A lot of it just might be something that's nudging you to move out of a sort of a status quo or a conventional set of norms. Who knows? I hope that made some sense.
I would love to hear what Donna says. And I also feel like I want to hear that, but
we need someone who can represent the womb here.
Yeah. Hello, everyone. Sorry, I was late today. This chapter for me, again, very complex ideas. Again, I thought I need to read it again. I don't know. I mean, it was confusing for me. I tried to make sense of what he's trying to say, especially towards comparing Heidegger's, being in the world. And I don't know. I mean, I'm not very expert in Heidegger, but I thought maybe what he meant, I haven't read a lot for Heidegger, but I felt maybe he's like Heidegger saying being in the world and that's it. Maybe he's trying to put like a sort of responsibility that no, there was a journey and a difficult journey to be in the world. So maybe we should understand our space, our being, our time in the world more than what Heidegger said, just being in the world and that's it. We're thrown in the world and that's it. I don't know. This is what I understood. Maybe I need to read more. I need to reflect on it. I mean, I don't know. This is what I collected from this chapter, actually. But again, yeah, it's very complex. I mean, for me, it was really not an easy chapter to read. Yeah.
Well, that actually comes back to something Michael was speaking about before you got on the call.
Oh, really? Oh, sorry.
No, that's okay, because he only mentioned on it. He only touched on it. He didn't. We didn't go into it. And okay. that's the difference between rather Sloterdijk saying that what he was doing in some ways filling in something a big piece of what Heidegger left out.
Yeah.
So if Heidegger gave us being and time.
Yeah.
Sloterdijk proposes to give us being in space. And is that your understanding, Michael?
Yeah, I think so. Sorry.
No, go ahead.
I think so, because he spent the whole chapter, establishing the journey in the womb and this celebration of coming out to the world. You know, in our region, in the Middle East, there are still some villages. Till now, we look at the womb of the woman as something sacred. And till now, I mean, for instance, Mother's Day, we celebrated on the 21st of March, which is the date of our female goddess, Inanna or Ishtar. It's well known. So the woman is very sacred and important. So I don't know. I mean, maybe he's referring back to history. Maybe he's saying, especially the first chapters when he tried to establish this, maybe he's trying to establish that, yes, we have to consider being indifferent from what Heidegger or maybe the existentialist, where it's your being, you're just there in this world, you don't know why. Maybe he's trying to establish, no, there is a journey and there is a reason for this space. Maybe we have to be responsible as human beings. When we said that I'm a human being, if God does not exist, I am not responsible. If there is a God who's not responsible, then I'm not responsible. Maybe he's trying to establish, no, let's be responsible for our being, for this space we're living in, for this time. I don't know. I mean, I felt it's more socialist. It's more a call for, something.
I don't know. I love that, actually. I think that I like that reading a lot, actually. I get a lot out of that reading. And the womb is media, I think.
The womb, very important.
And what would say, you know, in what way would it, could it be sacred media? In what way do we not treat it at that way at all?
I mean, some people in our region, and even to now, I've heard that in certain villages, they still worship the womb. You know, it's the beginning of life. Yeah. It's where we were created, the sacred blood, the sacred womb. As I told you, that even some of our grandparents, the old wives, the people, it's like, it's spring, it's the beginning, the womb, the woman flourishes. So, yes, our beginning is very important. The journey, the rebirth is very important. So he's trying to establish, the journey, this whole journey, your relation with the womb and how you came to the world is very important. You're not just thrown to the world. You had a journey, a long journey. So I think maybe you should appreciate the being. I don't know. This is what, I mean, still, it's very complex. His ideas are very difficult for me. I don't know.
Well, I like that reading a lot. And I think it also brings up, it reminds me of that Lao Tzu example again, because this Lao Tzu, he matures with inside of the womb, but then he leaves it behind. Mm. And he walks away without any further, it seems, without any further regard for it. Is there something irresponsible about that? Is there something insensitive about that?
But he matured inside the womb. He didn't come out as a child. So he got his maturity from the womb, if you can, in a way. Mm-hmm. And he wasn't thrown. And his being in time and space is not like he's just existing. He came out mature, and then this is where Lao Tzu began, and this is where, I mean, if we read it in this way.
All right, well, we have a few minutes left. Do we want to offer any closing reflections? Not too long, but some way to, I don't know if we'll tie this together. I don't think there's any time tying together.
Good luck on that one.
But how do we want to at least transition from this conversation to whatever might be next?
Well, what is next? What is the next topic du jour in our Slaughter Dyke book here?
Well, I think we're going to start talking about the placenta at some point.
Oh, hooray! Is there something I don't think about every day?
It's a freaking break.
And this is another place where, you know, in our culture, Western culture, that is to say, the placenta, American culture at least, is kind of a disposable organ. And that's not the case in most other cultures, most traditional cultures, right? So I guess we'll talk about that.
I guess we have no choice.
But, well, I'm sorry. Go ahead, John.
Do you want a summary statement from somebody?
Yeah, what have we learned, right?
What did we learn? It's a good question. Or what one thing, or what many things? And out of those many things we may have learned, what is the one thing that we could share with the group? Or what's next? I think I've researched a lot of prenatal stuff, and I've had a lot of weird experiences. I've also had lucid dreams and out-of-body experiences, which, our culture does not sanction, really. But, of course, there's an underground movement. There's a great deal of pop culture that's fascinated with these kinds of experiences. And I think we are starting to investigate it in a sort of scientific way. But it's going to be a new kind of science that deals with these paranormal experiences. So that's what interests me about this studying this text. And I will continue to research this material. But one thing I did notice, I think the in-between, being inside and outside at the same time, and the use of the Mobius strip and the twist and the Kleinian bottle, that hole, which is filled in ambiguity there. I think many of us have had these experiences. And for me, they happen in the inner ear. The vestibular system is the first system in utero that comes together. It orients us in space. up, down, left, right has to be established so that, you know, mitosis and cell division, cells go to where they go. They don't know where to go unless there's an orientation space. So it's very primary, that orientation space. And I often found in those, and I think he talks about the fetal experience is sort of floating in that amniotic fluid. And we often have had those experiences in meditation, no doubt, of being floaty, a very floaty kind of experience, very pleasant usually. So I think we can draw upon those meditative experiences, those trance experiences, our dreams, our experience of the imaginal realms when we enter into a good book or good piece of fiction or poetry. Because I think these are very important. That for me, it's all about aesthetic relationships and moving forward that agenda for me. So that's what I'm interested in continuing to open up to. So thank you for that opportunity.
You, John. Wendy?
I don't know. I'm with Ed on this one in a sense. I'm not sure how to wrap this up. I'll look forward to the next chapter and see what comes up, see what connections can be made.
What did you think about the conversation, or how do you feel about it?
Oh, I like the conversation. Like I said, I'm very curious to hear what other people get out of reading the same book that I am, because my normal everyday experience is I never see the world the way anybody else around me ever sees it. So, you know, in some ways that's good, in some ways that's bad. In this sense, it's good. I like hearing what other people took away from it and trying to weave my own interpretation within the threads of what everybody else is talking about. So,
okay, cool. Thank you, Ed. I have to brace myself.
No, I'll keep it short. Wendy brought up a very important point. It's about shared experience, being able to relate to something the author's saying, to be able to find some experience that's there. And I don't find that with Sloterdijk. I think Sloterdijk just goes on and on about shit. And I'll put it that way. This, because, and let me give you the because. Because it has zero relationship. I mean, when I love these discussions. I wouldn't continue with this pain if it weren't for you guys. And I'll tell you that right now. You're the only reason I do it. Because I don't think the man has anything to say. He's a lousy philosopher. He's a poor writer. He completely disrespects his readers. He's always telling us what we got wrong, what we don't know, what somebody else didn't get. He's the only person that understands Heidegger, apparently. I have no, you know, and I've read Heidegger some, but I've read a lot of commentary on Heidegger where people are wrestling with things, and they've always tried to make clear where they're coming from. And this making clear where you're coming from, I'm still missing here. He came the closest for me in this chapter where he reduces everything to me. And that's a game breaker for me. Because reducing things to something and nothing else is a showstopper. You can't do it. And to believe that he's trying to include all of us that he continually excludes, I think is illusionary, because he's not inclusive. He's not inclusive at all. And I hate constantly, I come to these things because I have the feeling you guys don't mind that I'm here. But in entering into this reading that Johnny pointed out, we get in there with the thing, and he's always telling me, why don't you go home? Why don't you go home?
You know, I did say that.
Huh?
No. I don't want you to go home.
No, not you. I'm saying Sloterdijk's doing it.
Oh, I thought you said Johnny.
Yeah, get out of it. You don't understand this? This is not your book. Go read something else. You know? And I'm like, okay. I'm the uninvited. All right. That's okay. But, you know, I'll just sit in the corner here and eat worms or whatever we do. But with you guys, I see this, And I really appreciate, believe me, do not underestimate how much I appreciate how much all of you are getting out of this. I actually believe you are getting something out of it. I don't think this is feigned. I don't think this is just putting on a show for the others in the group. I think you are getting things out of this. I don't see it. I don't understand how he can go on and on and on and on about nothing. And he does. And he makes up words and he changes meanings. And that's like I mentioned to Wendy when we were talking. He's like talking to Humpty Dumpty. You know, words mean whatever I think they mean whenever I use them. And if you don't like it, well, you're just not smart enough. And I'm not the sharpest pencil in the box. I understand that. But I can generally get through most things, but I don't know. I'm missing the point. I don't understand little factual. I think maybe that's where I stumble.
You're struggling to be born.
Quick example.
You're banging your head up against the
I know, and it feels so good when I stop. You know? This is kind of like arguing with programmers. It's the same thing. But it's like he says stuff like the reason the Chinese count from conception and you start at your year old when you're born is because 10 lunar cycles is a year. He said that is very explicitly stated in the text.
Yes.
And I have no idea how that works because there are 13 lunar months in a year. Sorry, that's just the way the universe works. I can't do anything about that.
All right, we're getting into details.
These are just little things. This is where I stumble. I guess I'll continue to stumble forward, hoping that you guys will help me out.
Please do.
Yeah.
All right, so Michael.
Yes to Slaughter Night. No, I mean, quickie.
I think that's great.
the quickie is that I think Sloterdijk is an original thinker. I think he's a provocative philosopher. I think he's uncovered material I've not seen before. And I think he's already beginning to shift my sense of the present moment, which is my criteria. Mm-hmm. What expanse his vision will have in reshaping how I see things is completely open-ended and unknown. That's where I'm sort of at. But I think it's very exciting enough that I would go through all the volumes and that sort of thing. So I think it's quite interesting.
Me too. Yeah.
Okay. I'll leave it up. Donna, if you wanted to add anything, you're totally welcome to. And if your previous comments were expressive of what you'd want to share, then that's cool too.
She looks awfully frozen.
I'm not sure if she's frozen or meditating.
I think
it looked like she was returning to a womb experience and was about to give birth to some wonderful insight, but maybe not. I think we've lost her. You can still hear us, Donna. I'm sorry, but we don't hear you right now. So I guess we should wrap it up then. Thank you to everyone.
Thank you.
Ed, John, Michael, okay. Donna.
Enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
And next,
really appreciate you all.
Next meeting is 2 weeks from now, same bat time.